carried. Now, Senator Burns, that we send out House Bill 1158 as amended. All in favor, call the roll.
Burns.
Aye.
Ivers.
Aye.
Feigen.
Aye.
Tyson.
Aye.
Jurenstead.
Aye.
Lynn.
Aye.
McCain.
Aye.
Wilner.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
Chairman.
Sure.
Respectfully, can we amend the probate code?
Just one, I have one more bill before we get to that I'd like to get out tonight, and that's 1261.
Bob Bond.
Oh, excuse me, Bob.
I wanted to say, as I was reading this bill, I see there are a number of differences in it to this act, which in effect would make, for example, your two amended sections part of the Uniform Act. If that was originally intended or not.
Well, that question arose before, since it's part of the Uniform Act, that we shouldn't amend it. And following our discussion here, we decided, as I recall, that we could amend it if we wanted to.
All I would point out is that where Section 1 says this act may be cited as the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, when we compile it, we would have to substitute not only the new sections, which make up the Uniform Act, but also a reference to ORS 97-130 and a reference to 116-115, which are existing laws that are merely amended to adjust.
Well, what do you suggest that we do?
I assume that where there are references in the Uniform Act itself, they are merely talking about Sections 1 to 9, which are the only new sections in the Act. These other sections are merely adjustments, I take it, which are not part of the Uniform Act itself.
On page 2, line 6, I move that we amend by saying, inserting the words after Section 1, period, Sections 1 through 9 of, and lowercase the t on this. Will I do it for you? Please let me go on.
Well, our other sections first. Section 2 is the same way. Section 3 has definitions which they apply.
Well, I don't mind the or. What do you think?
Well, I was really pointing out what would happen when the thing were compiled. When they say this act, it would include all these adjusting amendments as well as the.
Well, what do you think we should do?
Mr. Chairman, on
do
line.
Same, let Bob do it wherever he cares.
On line 6, after the word as the, before the word Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, we put the word almost. So maybe side is the almost uniform.
Why don't we let Bob really work them out?
Bob, why don't you work that out? Let's turn to 1260.
None of those words are used in Section 10.
What number did you say, Tom?
1261. This is the one in which there was a difference of opinions between the governor's office and the attorney general.
Mr. Chairman, we essentially got to decide what we want the attorney general to be doing. The issue arises in this bill, of course, arises in his bill giving him some additional powers in the area of criminal enforcement. At this point, I don't know what the attorney general is, so I suppose not to go at this point. I was concerned last session when the attorney general broke this bill in. It was his bill originally to be attorney general function. And then it was amended in this committee, so the governor was the chairman, he was the vice chairman, and I didn't go through. I assume the assumption the attorney general would still have some basic responsibilities, and the governor wouldn't be able to come to all meetings. And now the governor comes in and essentially deletes all functions of the attorney general under it, except the branch that testified and presumed the governor would choose to appoint the attorney general. I think we'd want to consider this along with the bill on giving him some criminal powers and criminal law enforcement and decide one way or the other on both counts.
Well, I don't agree with you. When the Attorney General came in here, you all received, I perhaps shouldn't go into this at all, but you recall his testimony, for example, with respect to gambling occurring in a certain county in the state. state.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, just a moment. In which he stated that he had notified the governor's office. The governor's office had done nothing about it. And what, someone from his office heard this and sent to me, and I think most of the members of the committee, Thornton's letter to him with a copy of his reply on... Thornton's letter was dated March 12th. On March 14th, he sent it to the state police with a request that they investigate it with a copy sent to Thornton. And Thornton told this committee that he knew nothing about it and he'd seen no information about it.
Mr. Chairman.
But I still think that this thing is, now they're receiving funds right now under the Omnibus Crime Control Act of the Safe Streets. And this thing is getting rather urgent. They talked to me about it today. Said that they should have it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to just read it. I believe each of received a memo from Ned Branchfield contradicting Thornton. After receiving that, I sent my copy of Branchfield's memo to Thornton and asked for his detailed comments. I have that. I didn't realize that bill was coming. I have that. And in my office, I'd be glad to furnish the committee. But Thornton apparently has answers each of the things Branchfield raises, and I think it would. So this bill on the basis of Branchfield's charge, you would want to have Thornton's answer.
Well, it isn't. I realize that. But the chair will entertain a motion to send it out with a new pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
I have to say something on this. Attorney General said something in connection with his testimony on this bill, including the fact that when I drew up the criminal law revision bill 2 years ago, that I had specified certain people to serve on the criminal law revision commission. So many judges, so many members of bar, the attorney generals. And ergo from that, he concluded that I, for example, I think he was applying me personally to support the retention of the language which he proposed in his crime control coordinating council bill 2 years ago. I have completely become convinced that it's a mistake to delineate heads of departments as people serving on committees. We are now in the process of rewriting the Traffic Safety Commission, which presently has a superintendent of the state police, a head of the Board of Health, and any one of a number of other agency heads, just as this, and taking them completely out and letting the governor appoint five responsible citizens to this board. That's what they're trying to do here. I think this is the right way to go, and if I had Senator Tuttle again, I would have drawn it broader, because frankly, some of the designated public officials were selected to serve in the Vision Commission haven't been. Perhaps we should strike that. But I think this is the way to go. Give them a broad statutory authority. And I should say, I didn't tell this to the chairman, but in defense of the Attorney General's position, when the combined law enforcement council considered this, most of the people voted with the Attorney General, but the Superintendent of State Police called me the other day and said that he felt that he didn't completely understand the presentation and couldn't get a hold of the chairman. He wanted to tell me and have me tell the chairman that he thought this was the right way to go. He said, frankly, if I serve on every committee to which I'm statutorily appointed now, I wouldn't have time to fulfill my duties in administering my office. And he said, I want to rescind the representation that I can oppose to this bill. So I want to, because my name was mentioned, I want to explain my position. And I think the record should show that I think
my only point is the reason I thought that this is tied to the other bill is that if it's our judgment on the other bill that the Attorney General do not have criminal law powers, and this would be Attorney General came in here and said, either give me some meaningful powers or remove me from the field of criminal law. If we remove him in the other bill from the field of criminal law, then I agree that he should have no role in this. On the other hand, if in the other bill we give him a role in criminal law, then he belongs in this, and he belongs in this very, very importantly. And that's my hang up on this. Now, I agree with you that we shouldn't try and in statute to name all of these state agencies. I agree completely on that part of the government. The only question I have is, in view of not having decided the basic point, whether we want to write the Attorney General out of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I don't think we're writing the Attorney General out of it, Don. He was written out of it 2 years ago, for all intents and purposes, when he agreed with it to have it go to the governor. And the representative of the governor's office said that the Attorney General would be on this, right, so, law enforcement council. You know, I have some very, very strong feelings with respect to the Attorney General and the area of law enforcement. And I sponsor the identical bill that identical to Senate Bill 192 2 years ago. I got drawn and quartered by the district attorneys of the state. And somebody drew that bill for me. When the letters to the editor started hitting the Oregon News Journals, and the flag started flying, all of a sudden they left all alone. There were some statements made in this committee, which ignored the facts that happened 2 years ago. I still think it's the right way to go. I believe in the California system, or the justice
system. Is this the bill of the district attorney's appeared?
No.
The chair will entertain a motion.
I move it out to pass.
You've heard the motion.
What bothers me about the movement that is occurring hasn't much to do with who the Attorney General is or what he's done in the past. The reason why we need something is because there's no state agency which is directly responsible for overall coordination of crime control and prevention in the state of Oregon. Now, it may not matter very much whether you name the people or not. It seems to me that we downgrade this crime function if we change the commission this rapidly and make it just a group of people who will be appointed to serve in the governmental pleasure. Perhaps it never did attain the status it should have, since its function was to prevent crime. I think I'll vote against it, not on the basis of personalities at all, but because I'm afraid that this will downgrade the state's responsibility in the area of law and order. This will do just as well to receive government monies, no question. It get the federal funds. Get the federal funds just as well.
All right, are you ready for the question? Call the roll.
Burns?
Aye.
Iverson?
Aye.
Faison?
No.
Husband?
Aye.
Jernstedt?
Aye.
Lynn?
McKay? Aye.
Wilner?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion carried. Shall we turn back to the probate code?
By the way, Chairman, I really wasn't kidding. I'm going to sign my tax return and mail it to Eugene between now and midnight.
We'll take care of these.
Which box are you going to put in so I can check out?
I'm going to put it in the main post office.
Senator Burns has some amendments.
Which one are you on?
On the probate code again now. I think these are the last ones.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, one of the people I practice law with probably handles more adoptions than anybody in the state of Oregon.
and about a little bit more than half the number of adoptions.
Who is that there, Mr.
Joss? Bill Joss. Now, he got over this originally, and since we started hearing about this, I've been in touch with Zollinger and Stan Allison and worked out. Bob, do you have the, see here? Yeah, Bob, did Stan Allison bring those up to you?
He brought them down from something around the middle of this afternoon.
Yeah, well anyway, Cliff Zollinger, Phil, and Stan Allison went over these changes in language. Zollinger and Allison agree that really what they're doing is changing the language, not the substance. He can't appear in front of the committee because of the rules of the Senate. Phil can't. So I'm just presenting these. I try to stay away from adoptions, but because of that, there's an ethics opinion that says that anybody that practices law as a member of the legislature can't ethically appear in front of a legislative committee. And I wish that I could explain it. I can only tell you I can provide you with written explanation. But
Mr. Love to be able to look at it.
Yeah, that's right. And I apologize. You want to also let Bob Lindy know? Well, Bob has a copy, but...
I have a copy. All right. Mr. Allison brought it down this afternoon and talked to me.
And he represented to you that this had the... It was a compromise agreement among the three of them. Is that right?
Most of these are...
What do you say? I didn't have anything to do with these.
I think he said he preferred it the way that a lot of them thought they should. I can point out a couple of things. You pointed out to me that there were changes.
I know it. Well, would you point it out?
Well, the section 28 on the printed sheet here is supposed to be substituted for section 28 on all illegitimate children in the proposed probate code. The primary difference in substance, rather than the terminology, is that section 28 of the probate code, the penalty may be established either under ORS 109-170, which is done in a number of different ways, but under the probate code, it can also be established if the father acknowledges himself to be the father during the lifetime of the child. That is done here under the separate sheet. That is one change in substance.
Of course, the probate code has changed the law in that respect by allowing a father to make a will by simply saying he's my child. Change his will.
There are a number of changes in wording which may or may not be necessary. For example, we'll note that section 28 on the separate sheet stands out for all purposes of intestine protection by and through or from any person. So the definition of all purposes of intestine protection, which uses that terminology, does mean protection by, through, or from a person, both lineal and collateral. And maybe unnecessary to repeat that aspect of the prayer.
Gee, I think our probate commission went into this till heck wouldn't have it. And I hate like Sam Helly get into a change.
Phil come down tomorrow and discuss this with formally with Bob Lundy and John Hudson, for example. Would the committee be satisfied with that?
Tomorrow? Tomorrow, or you mean Friday?
Tomorrow.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I'm with Fady and I are cutting slacks in Blue Jean tomorrow noon. We won't be here.
What time? You'll be gone the rest of the day?
Yes.
I think it'll take us that long to rest up.
Could you do it Thursday morning?
Not Thursday morning. At that time I will be drunk. He could, I don't like it.
Well, perhaps we could select someone else other than, how about, you don't want to do it, John?
Perhaps somebody else. Don might be able to.
Can you, you can. Don will be here.
Thursday he might be. Don might be Thursday.
Thursday morning?
Since 8:00 this morning, we've had lunch in 1 hour up and I haven't eaten this evening.
All right.
You know, we're back here at 6:00.
Then Thursday morning, would you make the arrangements for Phil Joss and, Bob Lundy and Don to get together?
What time?
Well, I don't care, 9:00. See, now wait a minute. Thursday morning, is there a deal in Crestwell?
If you're going to.
Are you in the legislature or on the road?
I think I could get out of it. The president, told me that he was going to send Senator Fady and I down to,
Crestwell on this. Tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night, so.
All right. All right, tomorrow night at 8:00 here.
I don't have anybody to get out of it. I don't have to. Yeah, we want to have Bob here.
No, but I mean, how is his plan for 8:00 tomorrow night?
8:00 tomorrow night is all right.
If they also could give us some marking of how this relates to what we got here.
That's kind of our office, so we're committed.
Could you have somebody in your office, type this up and show us how it changes since Bob?
I'm just looking at the first section.
Can you bracken up his door? I think we almost have to bracken out the whole section and write in the whole building because it doesn't do it, you know.
8:00, would you give me 3 minutes now, Bud?
Yeah.
One, how about 255, the charges for Banshee students? Gone over that. Gone over that.
Yes, I'm over out due pass. It's cutting down.
All right, call roll, Ed, just one more.
Kearns.
Aye.
Ivory.
Aye.
Bailey.
Aye.
Houston.
Aye.
Kearns-Smith.
Aye.
Kearns.
Chip.
Aye.
McKay.
Aye.
Wilner.
No.
Mr. Chairman.
The seniors now get them without charge from West Publishing, anyway.
Right. Now, that's right. Now, how about the Oregon State Bar fixing their own dues? 1060. You don't like that?
Move we defer it.
Wait.
Should we set that in special so we can think about it?
All right. How about deferral of jurors? 1243, Wilner, Crookham situation. It's okay. Each judge, you know, we have the presiding judge question.
Cheryl, I spoke to subcommittee. I spoke to Charlie Crookham. He says he's satisfied with the way it is. Remember, the problem was whether this language would undercut the authority of the presiding judge.
Right.
Move it out to pass.
All right. Very call the roll.
Bruni.
Aye.
Ivory.
Aye.
Bailey.
Aye.
Husband.
Aye.
Kearns-Smith.
Aye.
Lynch.
Aye.
Kidd.
Aye.
Wilner.
Good time.
All right. Now, are you ready? Do you want to take up the abortion bills now?
I'll take them up now if we're not going to get any other chance.
No, we'll have another chance. But would you rather?
What did you got for Friday now, Mr.?
Oh, Chairman? God, you got that many bills.
Have you?
Yeah, 10 of them for hearings. When do you want to take up the abortion? You know, the press is here, they want to know, no doubt.
You know, I wish they'd get it over with so I get out to quit getting these letters.
Evening.
How about Wednesday?
Wednesday? Fine.
What's tomorrow?
That? Yeah.
No.
After the.
I can't do that. I got to get 2 speeches and 4.
Well, when do you want a night meeting?
Well, it's fine with me, except I got a night meeting tomorrow. Wait a minute.
There's a night meeting tomorrow in Ways and Means.
Friday, immediately following our agenda, we'll take up the abortion bill. A regular meeting, Friday afternoon.
Well, I've got a Ways and Means Subcommittee, former education. I've got to go to Oregon State.
How about night meeting next week?
I've got to go to
next week.
Criminal law review.
Will somebody make a motion that our night meeting sounds
all right, morning. Let's
how
have
about
it next Monday night.
Next Wednesday night. How about next
all
Tuesday
right.
night?
Tell me what?
Somebody make a motion.
I move that we have a meeting next Monday night.
What's the 7:30?
What?
At 7:30.
That's all right.
Just
And in addition to the abortion bill, we will, I'll have on the agenda a number of other bills for an executive session.
Mr. Chairman, you and I have talked about 80 combination of 517. Do we have it on agenda for a court session meeting?
No, we cannot. The 80, we are first going, and we've already set, we've scheduled a hearing for the Department of Commerce.
Yes, for Friday.
Consumer, yeah.
That's this week, but I thought you were talking about a meeting for next week.
I am.
So since you will have heard 517 on Friday, the 18th, we have 80 and 517 on the work session for that next Monday, Monday week off.
I think that there will be...
That'll be Monday the 21st.
Yeah.
I have no reason to think that the amendments to the private investigator's bill won't be ready by that time. Ed Smith told me that...
Let's have that in, too.
Okay.
And if anybody isn't here, we're going ahead with the abortion bill anyway.
Chairman, can we take up the abortion bills the first thing?
Yes.
Because I know I've already got a conflict in another committee, but I'm...
You mean Friday night or Monday night?
Monday night.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could put on the head of the list the matter of the garnishment on contractors and the matter of the filing lien, and I'll have those bills...
I won't guarantee head of the list, I'll just guarantee it'll be on the agenda. And if the committee will stay with me, we'll get to it.
Friday.
Oh, is this set for Friday?
No, I don't think they are set at the moment. We've had some hearing done about that.
But if you have something, bring up amendments, why?
Sure.
All right.
Thank you very, very much.
Don,
8 p.m. tomorrow night?
Is that when we're going to meet?
I would like to explain to the proponents of 513, as well as to others, that the bill is relatively simple, and I think you can assume the committee understands it. With that in mind, I would appreciate it if you would make your presentation thorough, but as brief as you possibly can, and we do not wish any repetition. What is it?
This is a bill.
All right, well, please state your name, your address, and your occupation for the record.
I'm George Walden, attorney, practice in Portland, Senator McKay, members of the committee. I represent the car and truck rental leasing agency, the association, I should say. And I drafted Senator 513 with the help of the legislative council committee. And to sum things up in a nutshell, you have a present in statute 165.012, which deals with willfully failing to return lease or rented property. And this differs from that in two important respects. That bill requires a be made by the renter to the owner from the lessor 10 days, and that demand must be received. The present bill omits that requirement, and it further provides that failure to return rented lease property for more than 72 hours constitutes prima facie evidence of intent to fraud. There's the elements of it basically are that there has to be lease of rented personal property. There has to, in that lease, have an agreement to return the rented property at a specific time, and then the statute says that failure to return the property constitutes prima facie evidence of intent to fraud. However, the burden is still with the state, and the state would have to prove an intent to fraud. In the event that the property either is abandoned or in the event the renter fails to return the property.
the car and truck rental leasing association is nationwide. It has a number of members, and Mr. Fitzel can tell you how many in Oregon. They're going to the various state legislatures asking that what they call conversion bills, this amongst that, be brought because they cannot live with the present bill, the way it's written now, 165.12. It's unworkable in that you cannot make the man upon a letter, because in most of the instances he has given you an incorrect, fraudulent address, fraudulent name, fraudulent phone number, and if they could contact him in the first instance, they would go and try and recover their property without the necessity of going to the district attorney. It's in those events that he does not return the property, he keeps it, or in the event that he abandons it in some place other than where the agreement indicated that he would return it, that the problem arises. So basically, my association needs some help in this respect, and that's why the bill was introduced at Senator Inskeep's request that our association be had. That's section one of the bill. The other part is very simple, and it just provides that section two provides tampering with the mileage device called the odometer to constitute a misdemeanor in a sense. And basically with the new cars, this does constitute some problem. It's not as serious a problem as the conversion part of section one. Nevertheless, there isn't anything on the books now to take care of that situation, and that's why we're asking your consideration for a mileage tampering device taking section two. To sum up, we don't believe that the law is present with the adequate. We have a great deal of problem in working under that, and we do believe that if the bill were passed as it is, that we would be able to go to the district attorneys and the counties, get a stolen car report and a warrant issued, and this would then place the burden of going forward with the evidence on the defendant, who has the only knowledge as to why he's kept this vehicle longer than indicated, as to a defense, and I believe it's very workable. The only other thing that I would say is that this law was adopted from the Florida statute. Now, I'd like to present Mr. Bill Pitzel with American Auto Lease, and he'll give you some of the background of the practices with the car and truck leasing organizations themselves. Unless the committee has
any
questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Under plan.
Do they often take these articles across county lines?
County lines?
Yes.
State lines too.
Why can't you get them under section 4 of 165.110? Marching that AP. Which says that if you even take something across the county line without written consent of day or if you're only marching by day leave.
Well, I could give you, I would say, two answers for that. One is the present procedure and how it would be enforced would be very hard to work. And two, when you rent a man a car, which we're predominantly in, you're normally giving permission with the county line, such as they are.
That's still not the contract.
Despite they are contracts, if you cannot take the car into Mexico or to Canada.
Does it say it gives permission to units to take across the county line?
Explicitly, that word, no, it's not denied.
I have the tax on it, Mr. Michael. It says here, it doesn't talk about not denying. Mm-hmm. Or removes from the county where it's situated and obtained without the written consent of the bailor or vendor. It looks
looks as if you have to have the written consent in order to do it, or you're guilty of larceny by Bailey. Embezzlement by Bailey, as they call it here. 165010, which is a felony, which gives all sorts of rights, extradition, the whole thing. The mechanics and the enforcement of the present law is, seems to be the problem. It is very hard to get a complaint and to follow it through for a larceny by Bailey or embezzlement.
Mr. Chairman, because I may not be here, if you get to work session on this later, it's the usual problem. I had a bill in 1957 and 1963 to repeal that section, which is not the one they're attempting to repeal here. In other words, to repeal 010 on the theory that it was a monstrosity to say that you couldn't take a car that you had on a conditional sale contract across the county line without being guilty of a felon. And the police came in here, Bob Chappell among them, who was a member, and swore up and down that 165010 was their greatest tool in apprehending these people who rent cars and fail to return them. Just use it day in and day out in order to defeat the repeal of that bill.
Then what?
I was going to ask, are there any other crimes that you're aware of where you can you're trying to face it in the time that's in the way some of the ways you're going to be.
Well, that's a bit, I don't know of any under the Oregon statutes, the Florida statute, did it precisely. It made it kind of fix.
You know none in Oregon, in other crimes, proceeding this?
No, I don't, but bear in mind that the distinction is between going forward with the evidence and the burden of proof. The state still has the burden of proving a man guilty of attempting to fraud beyond a reasonable doubt. However, all this does is after you establish the lease, establish the failure to return the property, the abandonment, the period of time, it forces the defendant to put on his defense. In other words, it's a prima facie case. The defendant goes forward with his explanation that he's the one that will know why he kept it longer than he did or abandoned it in a certain place. And then, of course, the state doesn't impose, I don't believe, on its constitution.
Suppose you then force the criminal defendant to take a witness stand in the criminal case, and he testifies and says, I didn't return within 72 hours because I was ill, or my mother was ill, any one of a number of reasons which might be valid. Once you establish your case by a crime, by this presumption that you have, what have you done with the normal burden of proof in criminal cases?
I don't think you've tampered with the normal burden of proof. All you've done is shifted the burden of going forward at that point. I don't think that you've forced the defendant to take the stand because he has a right to remain silent as he wants. The state, though, does have the burden. And the overall burden of establishing each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't know that I've answered your question specifically, but because every case is going to depend on the particular facts and circumstances. Perhaps when the defendant gets on the stand and he says that he has been ill, that would constitute a reasonable enough excuse. And as a practical matter, it probably wouldn't come to where a warrant would be issued at that point because the detectives were working with it before. But that probably would constitute a defense.
Well, where in this act in the set up what the defense is like? He's got to go forward with the burden of proof. If he's got to go forward with whatever you want to call it, burden of evidence, even, you haven't specified here what he's got to come forward with.
I think he has to show the circumstances in it. He did not intend.
On the question of intention.
Right, it's on a question of intention, precisely. If he can show that he didn't intend to defraud the rental agency, he has a defense.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
The front page for this one, maybe we have it all through our connection with DUI out here, but the percentage is over 0.15. We have it in BBR, and we're going to have to get a quote to do. Governor, you're going to get through this in the criminal law, and I said...
I've already gone over prior to this one. Went through several drafts with respect to the baby situation, the problem that was the part of the day has been approved. Kind of the draft has been approved by the Code Commission. Start holding public hearings on this. I'm sure he's going to want to hear it, give it to the news.
Any further questions?
My name is Bill Patel, and I'm president of American Auto Lease and American Rent a Car. I'm also vice president of Catrala of Oregon. Catrala of Oregon is a fairly recent organization here. Catrala nationally has been very active for many, many years. Now, the Catrala of Oregon chapter, of which we have approximately 50 members, I'd just like to introduce a few of them that are here today. It's Mr. Sandy Erton, who is president of the Oregon Catrala, and with the Ford Rent-A-Car people. Mr. Jerry Scollard, who is with the Budget Rent-A-Car system, and he is a treasurer of our Oregon Catrala. Mr. Jim Aiken here, who is with the Airways Rent-A-Car people, and has had many years of experience. Mr. D. Green of the 50 Rent-A-Car Company is here. Mr. Rex McKinney, who is with Meadows Leasing and Meadows Rent-A-Car, and also secretary of Oregon Catrala. Our big problem, gentlemen, as our attorney has mentioned, is the workability of our present system. I think the one question this gentleman over here brought up about the gentleman had been sick. Let me point out that when you rent an automobile or a truck, you get certain information, and there is a due time back, and when this unit does not come in, of course, you immediately try to phone the renter. And it's when you get into a missing unit, you're unable to locate him, you find that you have a bad address or possibly bad identification, you do everything possible to try and relocate the unit before you even talk to the district attorney or to the auto theft division in order to obtain a complaint to try and recover your automobile or your truck. The gentleman that was sick could certainly call, I would think, and if the legitimate address and phone was there, we would have contacted him, found out he was sick, and made arrangements with him. I could recite numerous cases where our units were eventually recovered, and I can cite some that we never had them recovered. One of our main problems is the time element. When you do find that one is bad, of getting the car listed as stolen under a larceny by embezzlement complaint, so that the law enforcement agencies around the country have this information. Luckily, one time I had a car that was recovered strictly because the man wanted to cash a no good check, and he happened to open the trunk of the car, and the attendant could see an Oregon plate in there. He had an Ohio plate on the car. He contacted the authorities, and we had been in contact with the Portland Police Department, and at that time we were able to obtain a locate, and we had done everything we had down trying to find it. Luckily, they tied the two together. Had we no report in, there would have been nothing against that particular license holder. They may have had a man our property, and they may not have. I have one Thunderbird that went clear to Guatemala, which is quite a little ways from Mendel. Both Texaco Oil Company on a stolen credit card, our car in Guatemala, and I take American Express on a stolen identification card. All of us took the beating on that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Do you think that any of that was perhaps due to the carelessness of people who have inject signatures on credit cards and things of that kind?
Well, there is definitely always the element of human error. I want to point out, though, that, gentlemen, in this business, there's always the pro. And I don't care how experienced you are or how much training that you have with your counter people, the professional is going to get to you. We had a new Continental rented from the airport with entirely phony identification, we found out later, and he left a car from San Francisco belonged to Hertz that they were looking for. But he was the professional type that got the car from Hertz in San Francisco. When he thought it was getting warm, he left it at Portland Airport and called ahead for reservations and all. Represented himself as a publishing company out of California. His driver's license was a temporary, which is almost impossible to check, but yet these are legal. A temporary driver's license is just as legal as one with your complete name, description, height, and weight, and all.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think we do you a better service by telling you what's bothering us so you can talk to us.
Fine.
So that's why I'm interrupting. I'm a lawyer. My commodity is my time rather than the equipment I lease. But do you think I should be allowed to get my bills on page on 72 hours? Figured the guy who hadn't paid my bill is trying to flood me and have a criminal sanction to enforce my bill? And if not, how is that different from what you're saying? Why should you have a criminal sanction and any other person who renders services or delivers goods not have?
Well, there would be no need for going that far as long as we were able to contact you or you contacted us at the end of the rental time. You would want an extension for a day or two. We would review the contract, and if everything was okay, we would possibly extend it. We're certainly not going to run down on everyone that's 72 hours over the
bill.
Well, am I answering you, huh?
Ron, right, I understand.
You have to bear in mind that when a car is rented, it has some proof. At the time it's going to be redelivered. And we're not after the vast majority of people that bring it back and make arrangements to extend it. The situation that we're coming from is the man that just goes and keeps going. Perhaps he drops at the North Bend. San Francisco. You can't find it. The way it works now, we have to write him a registered letter, give him 10 days notice. The law now says that letter has to be received by him. Well, basically, a registered letter is going to take 2 weeks from the post office to be returned. So we can't go to the district attorney until 10 days, at least probably 2 weeks. Long at the date that he has agreed to return the car. And then we can go to the district attorney. You see, it isn't a situation where we're asked to really collect the bill. Here we have a situation where the man has agreed to bring back a piece of rented property, whether it be a lawnmower or whether it be an automobile. Time has expired and he hasn't brought it back. If he has, at that time, taken that car, he doesn't intend to surrender. In other words, he intends to defraud us out of our merchant. There's a crime. Probably it's a crime now. What we're saying, it isn't workable because we have to write this 10-day demand. It has to be received by them. And the pros, they give us a false address. We can't get noticed. The district attorney is reluctant to continue because of those defects. So what we're saying is after the expiration of 72 hours, when the time is agreed to bring it back, that constitutes prima facie evidence of attempted fraud. We're just trying to make it workable so that we can live. These people have a responsibility to the public to serve them in the best way that they can. They try and check out the references as best they can. But nevertheless, they can't run a complete credit check on a man, for example, that's landed at the airport and has a license from Iowa. Perhaps he has a druggist there, is out here to visit his aunt, wants to rent a car. Can't hold him up for a couple, 3 hours. You can check him out as best you can. But you're in the business of serving the public. The vast majority of them comply, there's no problem. It's the chief, the crook, that gives us the problems.
Any further questions, please, gentlemen? Thank you very much. Mr. Jerry Scollard.
Yes,
Sir, I take cognizance of the chair's comments regarding simplicity of the bill and duplication. Unless there are specifically questions, sir, I'll withdraw my...
Thank you very much, Mr. Stoddard. We appreciate that very much. I think the gentleman here explained the problem quite adequately. Mr. Hyder?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Doug Hyder. I represent the Oregon Retail Council. Mr. Gene Noodleman of Noodleman Brothers in Portland was very much interested in being here today to testify. Unfortunately, he had to go to the hospital and was not able to be here, so I indicated that I would appear on his behalf to give you perhaps a little bit different problem that this bill would hopefully resolve. I'll read you what he has said about the measure in very brief, just take a minute. This is from Mr. Noodleman, Noodleman Brothers Report. We have a great interest in Senate Bill 513, for we are plagued by failure of renters of our formal ware to return it upon the designated date, or for that matter, to ever return. When an outfit is not returned on time, we lose the opportunity for its use to another client. If not returned, it becomes a loss. In both cases, both the state and federal governments lose in taxes. In 1968, we had approximately $2,500 in formal wear that was never returned, which became a tax loss. In this calendar year, we are attempting to locate approximately $1,000 in garments rented since the first of the year and not returned. The situation is becoming worse by the year. We urge passage of a law as outlined in Senate Bill 513. If it were passed, I am sure that we could include a reference to the law and its penalties in our rental agreement. If there are further hearings, please let me know, and I will surely attempt to be present.
Any questions?
He
wants
to expand.
So it provides for a person property or two. Is there anything in here about the necessity for being certain that these rental clothes are clean and properly?
The question was, should there be something in the statute to provide that? I would certainly think that it should be provided if it is not elsewhere already provided, as I believe it is.
Mr. Hyder, are you familiar with Senate Bill 446 concerning the fixing of a tag showing cleaning instructions?
I have seen the bill, yes.
Do you think perhaps we could work that into this bill so the instructions about cleaning and the contract would have to show what was in it so it would be cleaning instructions?
I'm afraid I didn't understand the question, Senator.
The
446, as I recall, would require that the garments manufactured in the state of Oregon would require cleaning instructions to be attached to it when produced and distributed within the state or wherever.
Do you know Mr. Newman has makes any of these garments to where it's done?
I don't believe so. He's in the retail clothes business and in the retail rental clothes.
I wonder if the problem is even greater when they don't manufacture them and rent them.
Clean, but they don't tell people how they should be
clean. No, I'm sorry, I misunderstood the first question because my understanding is that it's little the people that do the clean. It's not the customer.
Oh,
I'm sorry. So I think they're required to clean them, but to the customer, I don't know.
Maybe we can have the president say before 46 initiaries.
Thank you very much, Judge. Senate Bill 514. Mr. Dave Dunaway. Thank you, gentlemen.
I'm David Dunaway, the state archivist, and I have here an amendment for this bill, which is drafted. I know it was introduced by someone else, but at the request of the McLean County, Representative Mrs. Randolph, who's director of Jeffers and Lexis. And she was concerned with the problem of using the computer or the data processing device in the creation of an index to current land titles. The present statute, which allows a county to create a general index, includes in it a provision relating to the satisfaction of mortgages, and I think this led her to the need, feeling the need for this particular revision, which is proposed in Senate Bill 514. Unfortunately, this language is not satisfactory because of the fact that it provides that this satisfaction of mortgage is not to be reported where a county are not reported by photocopying. Well, all the counties that I know of use photocopying. So it makes this into a negative amendment, and that doesn't accomplish really what they're after. Actually, when you look at the nature of the computerization and the use of computers, you're concerned with a problem which is mechanical. It's quite different than the normal creating a normal index. And last year, last session, which I think some of you may remember, we got a act through which allowed us to use computers in government and to use them, and not only that, but to certify the information on the computer. The amendments which I have drafted and have been approved by Ms. Randolph from Maine County and the people down there to whom she has submitted it would make this actually as an extra section on this particular ORS 205-140-160. And I've actually tried to spell out the terms under which the computer should be used. In other words, that the recorder is going to be able to use a computer to create an index, the kind of index where you can sit down to it and type out and say, what have you got on Mr. Yotori's land holdings in this county, and it can tell you what they are on a television screen type of thing. I don't know whether you're aware of the this online type of opposition, but I believe that's what they're talking about. I know it's what's now being used in the State Civil Service Commission for all employees. They have that type of device. And the problem is that the material that's on that computer is not available for quick reference. It's going to become an impossible problem if you just compile it year after year after year. And so what I've proposed here is that there should be an annual printout which would show what the current titles are at the end of the year and what transactions have taken place during the year relating to those titles. In other words, you'll have any sale recorded, you'll have any mortgage recorded, you'll have any satisfaction.
How much money would it take some isolated county to obtain the equipment to do what you propose?
Well, this is actually, Lake County already has the equipment, and this is a job that they will add to equipment they now already
have. Well, Lake, I'm thinking of other counties. It's permissive, Grant County.
This is permissive. Well, the others, I would say they won't do it until they have other uses.
All right, let me ask then. If we forget this for a moment, and we delete those lines with reference to photocopying that you suggested on lines 3 and 4, what effect will this bill have upon the counties that do not have this type of equipment?
It won't affect them except as they eventually develop the use of current equipment. In other words, this is designed for those counties that are actually in a position.
When Senator Husband introduced this, he simply inserted the language which you now ask be deleted. Was he aware of the problem?
Not that he was aware of the problem with the computer, but I don't know that he was aware. Mr. Weldon here from Multnomah County probably knows the background.
He'll testify.
He does know later, yes. Mm-hmm. But I do not know myself.
Any questions, Mr. Dunaway? No, thank you very much. Mr. Weldon?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, could we swear this witness? I think that is impossible.
I'll have you sign an override statement.
Hi, I'm John Weldon, Director of Records and Elections for Multnomah County. When I asked Senator Husband to put in his line 2, 3, and 4, page 3, my counsel in Multnomah County, Willis West, says that if he leaves the ORS now, you still have to stamp off the mortgage satisfaction in the book. And my reason for bringing this in is I understand Sherman County, and maybe Mr. Dunaway can correct me, I understand that this they might not have a microfilm here. But now when someone brings in a mortgage satisfaction, we record it, we microfilm it, and then we have to go to a whole bunch of books and look through and manually say it's been satisfied in an issue. And I want to eliminate that process, microfilm these books.
John, do you agree that the language that Mr. Dunaway suggests be deleted, it should be deleted?
Well, according to my district attorney, or Willis West, rather, it's necessary and for our protection, because as he reads the law now, he says we have to put still snap off in the books. I had hoped to bring 2 members of my staff down, but unfortunately.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this bill has introduced this Senator Husband does something unwittingly that it didn't intend to do, because our present law is a substance that provides that whenever these cases or discharges are brought in, the recorder shall immediately note the local general index and so on. Then by adding this language, he says the recorder of the county will not record by photo shall immediately. Doesn't say anything about what happens to them and those where they do photocopy, and then there, this magnification seems to be excused. And without any more, without adding something more, the bill does something that I don't think the intended would want to do.
Thank you, right.
So either it's, I think if we do, we have to go to something that those that they don't, they do still photocopy, they do photocopy.
Have you examined the amendment?
No, I haven't seen them.
Well, I have something further to say.
Well, I would say the amendment takes care of my original amendments in the bill. It does allow us to proceed with microfilm and to not stamp off mortgage. I want to abolish the quill pen in my office. Can I do you as a computer?
You belong to the Historical Society?
Yes, I do.
He has a whole room of quill pens down in the basement. All right, thank you, John. Mr. Dunaway, maybe you can shed some more light on the questions, Senator Rankin.
There is a microfilm law is also something you might want to look at. I can't remember quite didn't bring the law with me, but it's 192 point something or other, in which it says that when you use microfilming, the county can, by county order, do its recording in such way as it proves to be necessary. In other words, they don't have to follow the requirements of the book. And in many of the counties which are using microfilming, they have felt that they have taken care of this problem of the satisfaction by such a county order, and they no longer are actually recording satisfaction.
This happens to be a problem that I've met before in Multnomah County, and I know that Mr. West feels adamant about this. But I do feel that if we can encourage the counties who can afford it and who can create a computer-type index such as is envisioned by these amendments, that we will actually be improving the service to the lawyers and the public and everybody else that uses the public records of property, real property in the counties. I think that I would very much like to see this particular kind of amendment go through, but it's for a different purpose, essentially, than what started to happen through the legislation in the first place.
Well, do you feel that if we delete the word that you proposed and add your language, that would solve Mr. Wellen's problem?
I thought so. That is, if he's using a computer in his indexing room. Because what's it going to do? You're going to have a printout that shows the satisfaction that's been made.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, let me just ask Mr. Wellen to check with Mr. West and let us know by letter.
Would you do that, Tom? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Senate bills 93 and 358 will take them together. Mr. Keith Burbridge. These are bills that were in the Senate Highway Committee, and considerable testimony was taken with respect to them, and in fact, considerable time was consumed. Yes, I was there most of the time. But I don't know how they got to Senate. It got to Senate Judiciary. I guess that committee must have worked.
I think so. Senator Turry, Bob Oliver, who drew the amendments for 93 and 358, volunteered to come down on a moment's notice at a telephone call. If there's any reason for him to come here to explain his choice of language. And first, my name is Keith Burbridge. I represent the United Transportation Union. That's composed of most of the workers who actually work on the trains. I live 4271 Ivory Way in Salem. And our interest in this Senate Bill 93 and the companion to it, 358, is our need to get occasional or periodic access to the accident reports that this law deals with that are required of railroads to be reported to the Public Utility Commission. And as Senator Turry said, there's been quite a bit of testimony already, and so I'll be just as brief as I can about this. In the 63 and 65 sessions of the legislature, when the so-called full crew law was being battled here and eventually was repealed, the statistics that we brought to the committees and showed to legislators were attacked as being too all-encompassing, and that the picture of what we were trying to prove right here in Oregon wasn't quite as well defined as it could be if we kept our statistics dealing only on accidents that had happened right here, or the picture right here in Oregon. And so with the constant threat to our safety and livelihood in a hazardous industry, we feel a very necessary avenue for us to prepare any statistics to show legislative bodies in the future, or to govern proper advice to the PUC in terms of safety for railroad employees. We should have access to these public utility records. Now, practically every other industrial accident that occurs in the state of Oregon must be reported to the Workers' Compensation Bureau, and those records are open to public inspection. And very few other records of this nature are not open to public inspection that I know of. A few federal employees, like mail carriers other than ourselves, that's all that I've been able to uncover, whose accident reports are not on file. Now, the interest that we have in the report is really the interest is more, a little larger, but the report is a rather compact little thing. This is the accident report here, and this is a copy of the ground that is required for the railroads to be filed with the PUC. We're not interested in the accident reports of trains and motor vehicles. We're interested in these industrial accident reports. And we have several reasons to feel a strong need to look at those occasionally. First, we feel that it's of interest to us to know that all the accidents required by law are being reported, that the dollar value assessed sometimes might be of interest, whether certain railroad accident, industrial accident would come into under the classification as set down by the PUC rule as one in its definition of a reportable accident. And to be able to build statistics to ask for certain relief from the PUC at times if it seems to be there's a rash of accidents in any one particular area. Or in the event that the carriers again attempt to reduce the size of crews to a substantial nature like they have in some of the other states, why we certainly would want to be prepared to at least argue our case as solidly as we possibly can. Now, some of the testimony that was offered by a carrier witness in the Highways Committee was to the effect that the choice of language that I chose to use, and Mr. Clifton did when we described these railroad accident reports in the PUC as receiving a certain sanctuary or screen of secrecy by not being open to public inspection, and the other accident reports are open to public inspection. And this witness said that actually in his understanding that there was no sanctuary, that our sister states or the neighboring states around here had similar laws to this, and this wasn't anything new at all. So I wrote to all the 10 western states and to 12 of them, and I got replies from 10 of the western states whose laws are quite similar in some respects, and they differ considerably in the fact that they are not close to public inspection. You'll find the 10 here that have been answered, the only two of the neighboring states are the states of California and Nevada that I haven't included, and they do have the same sort of screen of secrecy that the Oregon law has and that we're attempting to have repealed here. But the states of Washington and Wyoming and Montana and Utah and Idaho and New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado are all open to public inspection. The states of Hawaii and Alaska come under a little different setup. Alaska is completely governed by the federal government. I mean, the railroad up there is owned by the federal government. Hawaii doesn't have enough railroads. They don't even have this sort of a law at all. So this isn't any departure from what is considered public business in other states. We feel very strongly that it is public business. It's most certainly the business of the railroad worker whose life and limb is involved here in these accidents that the reports deal with. And so we ask that the same status be given this law that had prior to 1937. When the law was put on the books in 1915, up until 1937, it was open to public inspection. And after 1937, it was closed. Very briefly on Senate Bill 358, that as the situation exists today, the law is there for the accident to be reported, but there is no penalty provision in the event that the accident is not reported. And we have suggested here that there be a penalty applied for the failure to report the accident and that it become a misdemeanor. And is giving it the same sort of treatment that nearly all the rest of the law in that section seems to be burdened by or enjoys, and so we don't feel that there's anything unusual about that at all. That, Mr. Chairman, is my testimony.
Mr. Burbidge, I have two questions. You should know, I think, that we, and I believe each member of the committee received a letter from the Oregon Railroad Association with respect to these two bills. Two questions I have. One is with respect to 358, do you feel that the ORS 760.035, which does carry a fine with it, constitutes a felony, constitutes a punishment or a fine that would cover the situation?
That it applies to which?
760.035. Have you had occasion to look and see?
No, sir, I did not.
All right. That's the first question. The other then is, do you feel that Senate Bill 93 will in any manner discriminate against the railroads? In other words, will they be treated in exactly the same fashion that this bill should pass as are other utilities in Oregon?
The other utilities in Oregon, as the law exists today, they're included there. They have to file their accident reports. And their accident reports are not open to public inspection, but they also have to file an industrial accident report with the workman's compensation. And so I don't feel that there will be any discrimination there in any area.
No. Your answer is that they will then be treated alike.
I would think so, yes, sir.
Any further questions, Mr. Kirby? Not thank you. Is there anyone else? Mr. Young. Mr. Burby, did you have anyone else that you want to testify?
No, sir, I didn't.
Mr. Young.
Chairman, Senators, my name is Oglesby Young. I'm the General Attorney for Senate in Oregon. I'm here today representing all of the Class 1 railroads which operate in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Young, one word of not a caution, but we've heard a great deal about these bills already, and we'd appreciate it if you, we want you to present it as thoroughly as you wish, but if you make it as brief as possible.
I intend to make it brief. As you indicated, Mr. Chairman, our points have been made by the letter which I wrote. I'll first talk about Senate Bill 358, since that will be very brief. As I've indicated in the letter which I forward to the chairman with copies to the members of the committee, there is a statute which provides that in the event an accident report is not filed by a railroad, the railroad is subject to a fine ranging from $100 to $10,000 for each offense. Now, if this bill should pass and make it a misdemeanor, I think the maximum fine will only be $500. I might state to the committee that the railroad legislation was there first. We had railroads regulated in Oregon before public utilities. And historically, when the public utility statute was adopted, providing for penalties where there are no specific penalties provided for otherwise in the statute, they simply borrowed the language from the railroad code. Originally, you'll notice that this bill provided that it would be a misdemeanor for either a public utility or a railroad not to report. For some reason or other, the public utilities were deleted by amendment in the Highways Committee. But almost an identical statute applies to railroads. And as I say, the public utility statute was borrowed from it. Now, with reference to the other bill, Senate Bill 93, I simply want to point out that since our hearing before the Highways Committee, the Public Utility Commission has published for the governor of the state of Oregon this biennial report of railroad accidents. Anything the Firemen's Union wants, and it's the Firemen's Division of the UTU, which is after these reports, is right here in this report, which has been prepared by the Public Utility Commission. If they want to show any member of the legislature how many more accidents the railroads of Oregon had, and this is limited to the state of Oregon, in 1967 than they had in 1966, it's right here in this pamphlet, which is available to the public generally. And I want to emphasize one other point. The Firemen's Union of the UTU already has access to all these reports. This report, which is filed in Oregon, is an exact duplicate of the report that is filed with the Department of Transportation. That report, filed in Washington, D.C., is available to a representative of the UTU. But the regulation provides and it's quoted in this letter, that the UTU, the Firemen's Union, can't examine or review those reports in Washington, D.C., filed with the Department of Transportation, unless they show good cause. They can't review a report, in other words, in order to get a witness's name or some evidence on an accident. They have to show good cause, and good cause is defined in the regulations. And good cause is something that will contribute to the promotion of safety in railroad operations. So if Mr. Burbidge thinks there's not discrimination here, I disagree, because this report is available to his union right now in Washington, D.C. I have nothing further other than what's needed in letters.
It's understandable. These are all so available now. What do you care about these laws that's in the making?
Well, Senator, if Mr. Burby just told you, and he was quite candid, he was before the Highways Committee, his union wants these accident reports for several reasons. One, he wants them so that they can determine whether these accident reports are even being filed. Well, I say to you that if they aren't filed, Southern Pacific Company, for example, can be fined $10,000. For not filing one report right now. Two, he wants to check the reports that are made out by other union members of the railroad, by clerks, not by A.W. Kilburn, the superintendent, or by me, a lawyer at the railroad, but by clerks in another union. He wants to check to see if the damage figures are correct when the railroads file an accident report. This is what he just said. Three, if there's a series of accidents in a particular area, he wants to go to the PUC, and he wants to tell the PUC, concentrate here. Well, we have a public utility commission who is giving the legislature and the governor statistics. We have a public utility commissioner who theoretically is watching out for the safety of railroad employees and the public. I think we should leave that to the public utility commission, not the fire commission. That's my point.
All right. I was just gonna say, nobody's gonna check up on the public utility commissioner. How do we know that he's carrying out what we theoretically think he's doing?
Senator Lane, if you want to know how many railroad accidents we've had in the state of Oregon, all you have to do is call the Public Utility Commission, and I'm sure he'll tell you.
It's not I that wants to know. It's the men that are concerned with safety on the job, apparently.
The people who are concerned with safety here, it seems to me, is our regulatory agency, the Public Utility Commission, just like it's the Workers' Compensation Commission. They're the people concerned.
Do we have a law similar to 293, I mean to 93 now, that applies to utilities?
No, let me go back a little bit. I disagree with part of what Mr. Burbidge said. This law, which requires the reporting of accidents to serious accidents to persons involving utilities and railroads, was enacted at the same time the so-called Oregon Crew Law was repealed. That's when this came into existence, this kind of report, the kind of accident Mr. Burbidge wants to check on. Now, that law applies to utilities and applies to railroads. And when the law was, when the bill was before the Highways Committee, this bill applied to both utilities and railroads. Now, and I don't understand the reason for this, utilities are taken out and it just leaves railroads. And that's why I have said in the letter that this is going to be put.
Any further questions? Not thank you.
I just want to add one more thing in response to what Mr. Lynn asked. Senator Lynn, all we're concerned about is that when these statistics come back to the legislature, they're filtered through an independent agency. That's really important.
Yeah, so the case can't be made either. You don't believe in an adversary proceeding. That's a matter of way of gaining truth.
I certainly do. You know that. All I'm saying is it's an adversary proceeding. The statistics are available right now.
Anything further? No, thank you. We'll go to Senate Bill 526, Senator Burns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jocelyn is here, who will testify on this
Jocelyn?
I happen to have three extra copies of a letter that I sent to Senator Burns.
Oh, yeah,
Burns.
I have.
As far as the book. My name is William L. Johnson, and the purpose of this bill is to eliminate uncertainty in the existing law with reference to the foreclosure of attorneys' liens. This matter was called to my attention in connection with a number of cases that have been prior, have arisen in Multnomah County, where I am practicing. And in connection with this, I discovered that while the laws are relating to other statutory liens, such, for example, as loggers and woodworkers, fishermen, police workers, farm labor, and so forth, have a specific provision for foreclosure set forth in Chapter 87 of the Order of Wise Statutes. The law relating to attorney's liens, ORS 87.495, is silent as to the specific measure of foreclosure. There is, in Chapter 88, a certain language which seems to relate generally to foreclosure of liens. However, the language of Section 88.410 includes the language there, except as otherwise provided by law, a lien upon real or personal property other than that of the judgment or decree may be foreclosed in accordance with the procedure set forth in Chapter 88. Of course, the lawyer's lien provided by Subdivision 2 of 87.495 relates primarily to the obtaining of a judgment or decree of a client and imposes a lien on behalf of the attorney on such judgment or decree. Consequently, in order to clear up the ambiguity which has apparently troubled at least two circuit judges up in Multnomah County, we submitted to your committee a suggested bill which you were kind enough at this late date in the legislative session to introduce as a committee bill. We want to thank the committee for getting that consideration. Briefly, this bill merely sets forth the standard procedure which applies to similar liens which are provided under Chapter 87 of the Orders Code. It provides, first of all, that the lien may be foreclosed by a suit. As pointed out in this letter, there is a dicta by the Oregon Supreme Court in the case of Crawford versus Crane, 244 Oregon 60, at page 62-67, which says, as a matter of dicta, that a suit of equity is a proper remedy for the enforcement of the attorney's charge of lien. And we have, therefore, embodied this dicta of the Oregon Supreme Court in this proposed bill, which is now before you for consideration. There's also the provision that in connection with the foreclosure suit, that any real or personal property and compensation secured by the lien may be adjudged and sold to pay the fees of compensation secured by the lien. And the court also may decree a judgment fixing the amount of the debt against the person or persons who owe the attorney and so forth. Also, it is provided that other persons which might be concerned with the property upon which the lien is sought to be enforced may be joined as parties to defend in the case so that their rights may be determined in one suit. That is the substance of the proposed measure. The purpose is merely to provide a definite means and to avoid ambiguity in the law with reference to the attorneys. We feel that the attorneys are at least entitled to the consideration that is presently given to chief burgers and court stewards under the law of the state. Are there any questions?
Senator Lane.
Just one reading this opinion by the court. When you first draft this opinion, you asked me, didn't you? You asked more.
I didn't get that.
Throughout this decree, the court refers time after time to plaintiff's assignee. I can't understand plaintiff's assignee. Doesn't he read plaintiff's assignee?
Well, I think that is the decree in this other case that might be.
Decree of Lewis versus Jocelyn versus Lewis.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know which one which person drafted that decree was not mine.
Perfect.
Well, all you're saying,
technically speaking, the attorney is signed to the plaintiff.
All you're saying, Mr. Johnston, is that as you look at the lien procedures left out.
The procedure for foreclosing attorney's liens is left out.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And this was substantiated by the position of Judge Roth, apparently, in this one litigation that you had.
Well, that was a position that we thought we were still working with him on that aspect of the case.
I see. Well, in any event, if we acted affirmatively on this legislation, if what we'd be doing would have prospective application only and certainly wouldn't relate to litigation.
That's right. In other words, there, this defect in the law was uncovered, and I felt that it should be called the defense as correct.
Would that lien be prior to any mortgage or anything like that, for example, existing time of the entry?
Well, in this particular case that was before the court, there was a prior mortgage, but of course the lien would have to take subject to any pre-existing liens. I don't think there's any question about that. You couldn't get ahead, for example, of a real estate mortgage by reason of the subsequent service of an attorney. In other words, the attorney merely wants to be put in the place of the client for whom he has worked and obtained, for example, a favorable judgment.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, that's right.
I was wondering how extensive you can buy this lien. Texas, you didn't check by against Allison or support money for children?
Well, of course, that question was raised in this particular case, and the court ruled, and I think properly, that with reference to the child support, there was a strong public policy in protection of children, and the court ruled that the lien would not apply to child support. On the question of alimony for the wife, there is a moral question that is down in my mind. In other words, I think it is something where the particular judge would have to use his discretion as to what he felt was the proper situation. For example, where there is a substantial division of property, particularly if you understand that people with valuable property, there may be a reason to say that the division of property that the attorney's lien should attach as to substantial property, which has been assigned to his client as a result of his.
I don't see anything wrong with it.
Go ahead, George.
In this suit that you originally represented the tenant here, what was the value of that house? Primarily, who got the other three fourths
of it? Well, of course, in that particular case, that was a divorce suit. I represented my wife. It was a very difficult case. There were been gone for a long time, and she went to the hospital. There were many complications in the case, which for personal reasons I don't want to go into at this time, because I don't want to say anything that is personal about the thing. But in that case, a great deal of work had to be done in order to protect the wife. There was a family home which was worth approximately $11,000 subject to a mortgage. There was someone 5 or 6